The Donald continues his merciless assault upon all things liberal and Obama, by now starting to pack the highest court with conservatives. And the conservative, his name is Gorsuch, emphasis on Gore, Neil Gorsuch, who's the nominee for Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. And Mr. Gorsuch is a highly regarded jurist, and was affirmed by something like 99-0 vote. So he will now suffer what all of the details, all of the related decisions by Donald Trump undergo: absolute, total rejection and total war. After which time he will be confirmed, my friends. It's pretty hilarious. The attitude, the fury that at some point the media is going to be so discredited, which is, I think we've already reached this point a long time ago. The media will be so discredited that people don't watch them anymore, don't buy their stuff anymore. And as their organizations fall apart, as they've already started, then you're going to find that these people are going to claim, as their organizations fall apart, as they lose their jobs, as they have to turn to other means of income, you're going to find these people claiming that they fought the good fight and that they were true to their cause, and that the only thing that matters is sincerity and fighting for the truth. And it's going to occur to you at around that time, you will recall that we discussed these things, and you will come to the conclusion that we were both right. You know, a lot of times when I talk to people that listen to the show, they say, not that, wow, you were so correct, thou man, I would have never thought of that, any something like that. What they say is, you said what was already on my mind. So I think a lot of times the show is a confirmation of your feelings, your beliefs. Because why? Because it's common sense. It's applied to these situations, these facts. And because you're not the kind of person who's a fact blind ultra liberal, you're a conservative, or you're a liberal, or you're a libertarian, whatever, but you're on the playing field, you're in contact with reality, and you're coming to common sense conclusions. And it's sad that when talk radio started out, that was basically almost the only place that you could get this type of thing. And then you had Fox News rear up and start growing. And now the news is out there that MSNBC wants to be the next Fox, which makes perfect sense because, number one, it is a growth model. It's a financial model. It's a business model. It's a model to make a profit on the one hand. On the other hand, it's a lot more interesting to listen to. So getting back to Gorsuch, here is a statement from Gorsuch. I will be a faithful servant of the Constitution. Neil Gorsuch is the choice to fulfill Scalia's place, and now you've got a number of justices that are very old, that are in their 70s or their 80s, and some of them are cancer survivors. Some of them are people that really would like some sort of a life after they retire. They don't want to die on the bench. So we're going to get probably a couple just like Obama did a couple, two, three, four justices on the court. When that happens, it's going to revolutionize the decision-making in this country. There will be no place to hide within the court system to get these crazy far-left decisions. You'll see some issues overturned. And according to Trump, can you imagine, my friends, and think of me right now holding up my hand, my hand tilted slightly backwards, index finger up in the air, a la Donald. But can you imagine, you think there's a firestorm over a temporary hold on 109 immigrants or travelers in the last couple of days? You think there was a firestorm over that? Wringing of hands, crying out, and just absolute excoriation on the Trump. Ben, wait till you see abortion begin to be debated on the court, and if it's overturned, you're not going to see anything like it. I believe the left would go to war over abortion in a way that we've never seen before, because it is just as every great empire has to have a life principle, liberalism, far leftism, has a death principle, and you can't fool with that, my friends. Anyway, here's Neil Gorsuch.
Mr. President, thank you very much. Mr. President, Mr. Vice President, you and your team have shown me great courtesy in this process. And you've entrusted me with a most solemn assignment. Standing here in a house of history and acutely aware of my own imperfections, I pledge that if I am confirmed, I will do all my powers permit to be a faithful servant of the Constitution and laws of this great country. For the last decade, I've worked as a federal judge in a court that spans six Western states, serving about 20% of the continental United States and about 18 million people. The men and women I've worked with at every level in our circuit are an inspiration to me. I've watched them fearlessly tending to the rule of law, enforcing the promises of our Constitution, and living out daily their judicial oaths to administer justice equally to rich and poor alike, following the law as they find it, and without respect to their personal political beliefs. I think of them tonight. Of course, the Supreme Court's work is vital not just to a region of the country, but to the whole, vital to the protection of the people's liberties under law and to the continuity of our Constitution, the greatest charter of human liberty the world has ever known. The towering judges that have served in this particular seat of the Supreme Court, including Anna Scalia and Robert Jackson, are much in my mind at this moment. Justice Scalia was a lion of the law. Agree or disagree with him, all of his colleagues on the bench cherished his wisdom and his humor. And like them, I miss him. I began my legal career working for Byron White, the last Coloradan to serve on the Supreme Court, and the only justice to lead the NFL in rushing. He was one of the smartest and most courageous men I've ever known. When Justice White retired, he gave me the chance to work for Justice Kennedy as well. Justice Kennedy was incredibly welcoming and gracious. And like Justice White, he taught me so much. I am forever grateful. And if you've ever met Judge David Sentell, you'll know just how lucky I was to land a clerkship with him right out of school. Thank you. These judges brought me up in the law. Truly, I would not be here without them. Today is as much their day as it is mine. In the balance of my professional life, I've had the privilege of working as a practicing lawyer and teacher. I've enjoyed wonderful colleagues whose support means so much to me at this moment, as it has year in and year out. Practicing in the trial work trenches of the law, I saw too that when we judges don our robes, it doesn't make us any smarter, but it does serve as a reminder of what's expected of us. Impartiality and independence, collegiality and courage. As this process now moves to the Senate, I look forward to speaking with members from both sides of the aisle, to answering their questions and to hearing their concerns. I consider the United States Senate the greatest deliberative body in the world, and I respect the important role the Constitution affords it in the confirmation of our judges. I respect, too, the fact that in our legal order, it is for Congress and not the courts to write new laws. It is the role of judges to apply, not alter, the work of the people's representatives. A judge who likes every outcome he reaches is very likely a bad judge, stretching for results he prefers rather than those the law demands. I am so thankful tonight for my family, my friends, and my faith. These are the things that keep me grounded at life's peaks and that sustain me in its valleys. To Louise, my incredible wife and companion of 20 years, my cherished daughters who are watching on TV, and all my family and friends, I cannot thank you enough for your love and for your prayers. I could not attempt this without you. Mr. President, I am honored and I am humbled. Thank you very much.
Very well-spoken guy. And he did, I think he did something, looking for his background here. He did Harvard University, Harvard Law, but he must have been a, I have to look it up right here, but he must have had a Rhodes Scholarship or something, because he also went to Oxford. And so he's got a, I'll have to do some more research on him, but I'm looking here. Okay, so he received a Marshall Scholarship, not a Rhodes Scholarship, but he was, this is absolutely amazing. And I'm wondering if he's Catholic or if he's Protestant. Very nice. He splits the difference there. He's Episcopalian, Anglican. He went to Oxford and was supervised under one of the most important natural law philosophers of the day, John Finnis, who I just happened to have a couple of his books on the natural law. And Finnis is from Australia, and he is, anyway, John Finnis, and I think he's, John Finnis is, well, I don't want to say whether he's Catholic or not, but a lot of these natural law people are Catholic. Here is the announcement from President Trump on Neil Gorsuch. And, from USA Today.
Today, I am keeping another promise to the American people by nominating Judge Neil Gorsuch of the United States Supreme Court to be of the United States Supreme Court. And I would like to ask Judge Gorsuch and his wonderful wife, Louise, to please step forward. Please, Louise, Judge. Here they come. Here they come. So was that a surprise? Was it?
All right, so it's mentioned by Gorsuch mentions White, Byron White, and Byron, who went by the nickname Wizard White, was a good friend of Jack Kennedy's, and he was kind of the Christian McCaffrey of his day. He set the record for average yards per game, and very impressive guy, but a person who, if you wanted to find somebody who believed in the work ethic, the Protestant work ethic, you couldn't find anybody better than Wizard White, because when he retired from the Supreme Court, I think he went on to another court for about 10 years, but a tremendous football player, obviously. And so anyway, what a great person to train under. All right, so we're listening to Ray Charles this week, His Country, and Willie Nelson said that Ray Charles did more than any other artist to popularize country music. And what Ray Charles did in his country and Western recordings is he brought in the sentiment and the swing musicianship of R&B, which Ray Charles invented R&B, and used it on country classics and totally popularized it. His albums, country albums, went to the top of the charts. And so 622 AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450, and we'll come back and talk a little bit more about the Supreme Court.
The news is out all over town that you've been seen just a running around. I know that I should leave, but then I just can't go. You win again.
Actually, I found an essay by John Finnis on natural law that I'll play for you in a minute. It says natural law theory in less than 6 minutes. So let me give it a listen off the air and see if it's something you might find notable. But this guy Gorsuch is the choice. He sounds like a humble guy. Number one, when he spoke, he kind of had that air, but they said his rulings are very readable. And I think that's one of the obvious markers for someone who's down to earth, trying to make themselves known. All right, so who is Neil Gorsuch? Well, let's get just a little statement here from Trump on this. Not too much, but 13 minutes. But we'll just maybe do a little bit of this on Neil Gorsuch, the new pick for the Supreme Court.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. When Justice Scalia passed away suddenly last February, I made a promise to the American people. If I were elected president, I would find the very best judge in the country for the Supreme Court. I promise to select someone who respects our laws and is representative of our Constitution and who loves our Constitution, and someone who will interpret them as written. This may be the most transparent judicial selection process in history. Months ago, as a candidate, I publicly presented a list of brilliant and accomplished people to the American electorate and pledged to make my choice from among that list. Millions of voters said this was the single most important issue to them when they voted for me for president. I am a man of my word. I will do as I say, something that the American people have been asking for from Washington for a very, very long time. Thank you. Today, I am keeping another promise to the American people by nominating Judge Neil Gorsuch of the United States Supreme Court to be of the United States Supreme Court. And I would like to ask Judge Gorsuch and his wonderful wife, Louise, to please step forward.
All right. So that we already played a little bit of that. What kind of a person is Gorsuch? Let me play a clip from a friend of his to comment on who he is as a person.
Well, most of the country is just meeting Judge Neil Gorsuch for the first time tonight. What is our likely next Supreme Court justice like as a person? And for that, we go to someone who has known him for an awfully long time, at least 25 years. Norm Eisen is a former U.S. ambassador to the Czech Republic and served as President Obama's ethics czar in his first term. He's a lawyer and was Gorsuch's classmate at Harvard Law School, class of 1991. In fact, they both graduated alongside President Obama, and he joins us now. Ambassador, that's an amazing class you had at Harvard. What is he like?
Tucker, thanks for having me. He's very much like what you saw tonight from the White House. Intelligent, well-spoken, kind, dignified. He's a terrific guy.
Did you know when you went to school, though? I mean, it's 500 people in a class, all of them impressive. Did he stand out as someone especially impressive?
Neil was one of a group of conservatives at the school.
Even then?
Even then, conservative. That was a time at Harvard Law School of strong partisan sentiment in legal ideology. It kind of foreshadowed the situation in the Beltway today, Tucker. And so he was one of those conservatives. I would say that I got along well with all of them. There were some who, like me, were a little louder in their views, mine liberal. We debate. Soft-spoken, very penetrating questions, smart, and listened to the answers. That was very, very impressive.
Now, so, I know that former President Obama was involved in politics, or at least in debating legal ideology at Harvard Law School. Did they ever interact, do you know of?
You're testing my memory now. The three of us must have been in classes together at some point, but I don't remember any specific interaction.
So as a liberal who's been in around politics his whole life, when you look at this, does he seem like this nomination? Does Gorsuch seem like someone out of the mainstream to you?
Tucker, he doesn't seem out of the conservative mainstream.
Right.
He's in that Kennedy mold, the clerk for Kennedy. Trends have swung a little to the right, so he's somewhat to the right of that. But within the conservative mainstream, normally this would be a slam dunk nomination, as his previous confirmation was
the
circuit. But the overhang of Garland, which has left many of us bitter, myself included,
right.
Merrick Garland, no less intelligent,
right.
No less decent, no less deserving of a seat on that court, and the resistance to Garland will create some storm clouds for Judge Gorsuch.
Storm clouds coming. Well, we'll at some point here, let me get back into the natural law theory. Natural law theory is arguably the most important legal theory, the most influential theory in the history of the world, I would guess, and it separates the continental from the Anglo-American theory of law. And if you're going to demand a little multiculturalism, Islamic law doesn't rate, Sharia law doesn't rate, and the legal theories of the rest of Asia are not important in this sense. But I would say, well, the European legal tradition was absolutely rocked to its core and highly influenced by the rediscovery of Roman law in the 11th century. So, and the claim is that Roman law didn't have a lot of influence on the English law and then the American law. 6:35, Kelly O'Connell will come back and get into more of this, but it's interesting. the best thing that the court could do is to avoid another liberal. Liberalism is highly destructive. Ultra-liberalism, not the type of liberalism you believe in, but ultra-leftism is a theory that does not have a legal or jurisprudence, legal philosophy. It doesn't exist in it, and I spent a lot of time looking for it before I finally came to that conclusion. We'll be right back. AM Las Cruces, AM 1450. 523-1450 to call in on AM Las Cruces with Kelly O'Connell.
What everybody knew but me.
All right, so I'm looking more into John Finnis. Like, I have his book, but to be totally honest, I haven't read the whole thing. And I think the one that I have is Natural Law and Natural Rights. And then there's a second edition of that. And I think I have the first edition. But here is just one thing that you would pick up from this. I think Finnis is Catholic, but I couldn't be sure about that. But so Andrew Sullivan is this, you know, kind of famous blogger. He's a gay blogger and he's more conservative, you know. He writes that Finnis has articulated an intelligible or an understandable and subtle account of homosexuality based on the new natural law, a less biologically based version of natural law theory. In this view, he argues that the state should deter public approval of homosexual behavior while refusing to persecute individuals on the basis of their sexual orientation. Basing this position not on the claim homosexual sex is unnatural, but that the idea that it cannot involve the union of procreation and emotional commitment that heterosexual sex can. I would actually kind of tend to agree with that. You've got these people that are going around that are demanding Old Testament law, which I find one of the craziest ideas when I really got down and began to think about it, because as I had mentioned, if you were listening before and I'd kind of thought through this, Cruz had gone to this, Ted Cruz may or may not believe in that idea. I don't think he's necessarily commented on it, but he went to a conference in which they were demanding Old Testament law. And there's this idea that I do ascribe to at a certain level that, you know, this, you know, nations are under the judgment of God. Has to be true, because when you see nations that are wildly out of step with that, they tend to get cut down pretty fast, the Russias and the Chinas. But the idea that came out of this conference was one of the ideas, we have to apply Old Testament law. So then I thought, well, you can't just apply the law when you don't know anything about it other than what's printed in the Bible. You would have to see, just like in court here in America, the law is not as important as the application of the law, right? So how is the law applied? And I went back and I began to try to study and find out what the punishment phase was for these laws. For example, there's a law in the Old Testament, if you disrespect your parents, that's punishable by death. But that, so who would report a child was punishable, that a child was disrespecting his parents to the Sanhedrin or whatever legal body there was, it would be the parents. How many parents out there would like to see their children killed, you know, maybe at the time when they're being disrespected, but the number of parents who would want to see their children executed for being sassy or whatever, it's got to be extremely minuscule. What I found out is that public executions in ancient Israel were pretty rare. And so you would have to, I think that, you know, the natural law isn't just the Old Testament law put into a philosophical doctrine. It's a lot more than that. But just kind of thinking out loud here, you'd have to evolve the law to try to apply it to society. And I think that's one way you could do it. For example, come to the conclusion that, for example, homosexuality as it is practiced in human society is detrimental to human existence, and then say, well, therefore the gut, you know, which you can prove through statistics. At the same time, you would say, I think these people have a right under their constitution to express their beliefs or their, you know, so you would differentiate in the law between, it was the law now promotes homosexuality without any analysis as to whether it's a public good. And I do happen to have a degree in public policy, so a master of public policy, but I find the topic pretty interesting. What are the policies that would be building up and be positive for the society? So just to say, for the sake of the argument, the government took the position, got rid of gay marriage, got rid of gay adoption, and took the position that it wasn't going to promote homosexuality, at the same time leaving an area for the private expression of it, if that makes any sense. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I number one, don't think Old Testament law can be applied. But if it was, it would be extremely cruel, I think, because you'd have all these idiots that are coming along demanding that it be applied, and then for the people that broke the law, that they be executed. And I just, you know, that has never been in the history of America. I mean, well, you could get into the witch trials, but those are a separate thing that we maybe do a show on one of these days. Let's take a break and come back, and we'll talk about the playbook that the Democrats are going to use against Gorsuch. 523-1450, if you want to call in, please feel free to call in and disagree. We'll be right back on AM Las Cruces.
Trust in you was my great sin. What can I do? What are you wearing?
All right, so we've got this new guy coming in, Neil Gorsuch. What does he believe? Well, he's from Colorado. He believes in originalism, the idea that the Constitution should be interpreted as perceived at the time of enactment, and textualism, the idea that statutes should be interpreted literally without considering the legislative history and underlying purpose of the law. He's opposed to judicial activism. He believes in states' rights and federalism. In terms of social issues that would touch on Roe v. Wade, he hasn't written on Roe v. Wade, but he was opposed to euthanasia and assisted suicide. He's got a wife and two daughters, and they live in Boulder, Colorado. He enjoys fly fishing, and he once went fly fishing with Justice Scalia. Now, he's been around the Supreme Court for a long time as an assistant, so a clerk of the court. Here's the playbook they're going to use against Gorsuch, even though he seems like there's no chance they're going to block this, but here we go.
Brad Hammer joins me, syndicated columnist and Fox News contributor. Charles, what's on your mind? What are your thoughts as we wait for this moment?
Well, we're down to a choice that for conservatives is a very good one. I think either one would please conservatives. I think just about anybody on the initial list of 21 possible Supreme Court choices was reassuring, and it certainly helped Trump to get reelected, to get elected. I think that really made an impression. Large number of people on the exit polls said that the choice of Supreme Court was extremely important for them, and the ones who did generally went for Trump.
Yeah, it's a great point.
So I think either one would be very pleasing.
Yeah.
Gorsuch choice, I think, will be, if that is the choice, it'll be a particularly welcomed one.
All right, so you'll have the moment tonight where everyone in the White House is happy and clapping. And, you know, as you say, conservatives will be pleased with the choice. But, you know, and I know that tomorrow this battle is going to begin. Characterize what you think this is going to be like for us. Is it going to be like Clarence Thomas all over again?
The Democrats are not going to wait until tomorrow. The muskets are going to start to fire within minutes on tweets and elsewhere, and the bombs bursting in air. The Democrats will be right out of the gate. They probably have prepared all the talking points and the personal attacks before even knowing who the choice was going to be. So I think they are ready. They have their playbook. Extremists, not in the mainstream, is not sensitive to the Constitution. Misogynist, not sensitive to women's rights, civil rights, etc. That's all prepared. It's ready to go. It's a fill-in-the-blanks assault, and it'll start right away. And it will fail.
You know, we're watching this live shot now.
All right, now here is from Chris Matthews, what to expect from the left.
Correct way. All right, Aaron Melber, thank you for that. Still, Chris Matthews. And Chris, you know, this to me is, this all seems very transactional to me in this sense. It always seemed to me that it was very clear, almost the president talked about transparent. It was a transparent kind of bargain in which Donald Trump essentially said, look, I don't really feel strongly or invested in this area. I know you guys, meaning the institutional Republican Party, really care. So just basically give me some names and I'll give you what you want. And basically, saw tonight.
Well, that's true, I think, of his social issues position. I mean, no one really believes that deep down Donald Trump is pro-life in terms of the law, in terms of banning abortion, for example. But I do think that a lot of it has been channeling Scalia. I thought that Judge Gorsuch sounded like Scalia talking about, I like law. I don't like to have the Constitution reinterpreted like we did with the cases of Kansas, the first case back in 54, and all the other cases since about public school of prayer and abortion rights and the Lawrence case. A lot of those are landmark cases that involve looking and finding something in the Constitution in terms of our rights that wasn't seen before. It was inherent, but it was there. I think this is going to come down, Chris, to a sad denouement. I think it's going to take 60 votes to get this approved. And I think the Republicans will have their rank and file, 52 votes will be there. But I don't think the Democrats are going to give them a single vote, which means this will go to a filibuster. And then, and I hate to cut to the chase, but I will. It's going to be up to Mitch McConnell.
Yep.
He's going to have to choose between something he deeply believes in. He really believes in, as an institutionalist in the Senate, the need to make the Senate different than the House, to have a filibuster requirement of 60 votes. It keeps it from being too extreme in either direction, requiring cabinet members, because everybody has to go through that 60-vote requirement, a threshold. He's not going to give that away easily. Trump says he will, but I don't think Mitch McConnell will. So in the end, it's going to be Mitch McConnell making a decision. Do I give up the filibuster rule, which requires 60 votes to get something through? If that means giving up something I believe and do it just for Trump to get his first nominee through, I don't think he'll do it. I think Mitch McConnell will hold fast and say it's going to be 60 votes. This ballot, he's probably a good guy, very much like Antonin Scalia, a good person, whatever you think of him, politically and ideologically. And I don't think it's going to get through because I don't think they're going to get 60 votes because I don't think they'll get a single Democratic vote, not a one.
Yeah,
because this country is so polarized now, and you know it as well as I do. Look at the DeVos nomination for Education Secretary. You can just see united party fronts on this kind of vote.
All right, I'm going to just differ with Chris Matthews, who's been around for a long time. He was the aide to Speaker Tip O'Neill, I think. I have to go back and look at this, but I would disagree. There's no way that Mitch McConnell is going to walk away from this nominee. He's too good. And he's going to say to himself, we may never get a judge of this quality coming into the Supreme Court again. We're going to break the cloture rule or whatever you call it, and we're going to get this guy in through the same rules that Harry Reid broke the dam open, and now the Democrats have to suffer for that. 6:59, Kelly O'Connelly in Las Cruces. We'll be back after break on the hour. 523-1450.
What can I do?
Sorry for
your
victim now. 'Cause soon his head
like mine will bow.
Like mine will bow.
Say what you will about Donald Trump's approach to things, but I will just, let me say this. What were we talking about yesterday and the day before? The ban, right? This worst decision in the history of the West. Greatest mistake, and it cannot stand. State governors arising and leaders of corporations saying we will fight to the death over this ban by Donald Trump. In the meantime, 2 days later, what are we talking about? Do you hear anybody talking about the ban right now? So maybe the whole purpose was to get this guy on the Supreme Court. Now, the mood out there is grim for the Democrats. And although they are standing up and stating that whatever the cliches are, this will not stand. We must unite. You know, I would say that one thing, or ask you one thing. What is it that leftism believes in? What are the pillars of leftism? We know what the pillars of the conservative movement are. But the left says it has to stand up and fight for their beliefs. It cannot be stolen from them. What did they achieve while Obama was in the White House? When at one point they had both the House and the Senate, and there was talk about completely obliterating the Republican Party, turning it into a B team. So, you know, they didn't really achieve anything except the destruction of their own party, right? So let me do a couple of things here, one of which is, let me read you some, headlines here, and I'll go through a couple of the different best sources here, but do a little bit of Drudge and a little bit of Google News. Do some Google News here. Neil Gorsuch, President Trump's anti-choice pick for the Supreme Court, according to Salon, which is a very dramatic publication. And NPR, why Gorsuch's nomination is likely to play out as an angry partisan battle, which we already, I believe, know why that's going to happen. People are angry. You know, and the left is never above destroying everything so that people can't do what they want in opposition to them. Top Senate Republican says Trump's court nominee will be confirmed, and that is Mitch McConnell. As I was just saying, there's no way they're going to let this guy walk away. So, boom, 2017 job growth starting with a bang. President Trump's trip to a Harley-Davidson plant was reportedly canceled to avoid protests. Poll, 1 in 4 voters believe Trump's vote fraud claims. Well, they found already that almost a million illegals voted. And that's out there as a fact. It's not put out there as just supposition. I think it was 940,000, something like that. Let's see what else here. I'm looking for anything else that you can't live without. Here's news, important news. Americans eating so much bacon that bacon reserves, you didn't know there was such a thing. You knew there was oil reserves, but you didn't know there was bacon reserves, are at a 50-year low. ExxonMobil dodges question on Trump's ban aimed at oil-rich Muslim countries. Interesting. And, all right, so let's, and I just to break up the monotony of the politics 100% of the time, I've got a little thing on space law that I thought you might find notable. And the upshot on that is that this billionaire is planning to go to the moon and become a trillionaire. And looking for any other... All right, so here is from the Drudge Report on Gorsuch, and one income for all, far-fetched or future fact, that's the dream of socialism, get rid of war and get rid of all envy by making everybody earn the same amount. Johnny Depp owns 14 homes or owned 14 homes, isn't that nice? That's the actor of the people, right? This guy who was... San Francisco suing Trump over executive order. 900 State Department officials signed protest memo. Why not give those people their walking papers so that they can become living martyrs? Now, this is something that was mentioned to me yesterday by another attorney. The wall is awakening Mexican patriotism to the point where, and he said that he had a lot of friends that were back in Mexico. And he didn't grow up in Mexico, but he's got strong ties to Mexico. And he said that there's this huge movement towards nationalism in Mexico, and that would mean using their own supermarkets over Walmart, that type of thing. So I thought that was interesting. African leaders cautiously back strategy to quit global court. So that's another attack against globalism. And student expelled for sexual misconduct is not allowed to defend himself. I got to see where this is from, because it would cause psychological damage to or trauma to the accuser. And that was the direction that a lot of things were heading in, I think, before Trump won the election, is you were going to get more and more of this touchy-feely type of law and getting rid of due process and focusing on these ultra babies, super babies that cannot be disagreed with at school. So people are getting sent to university system and becoming even more and more ensconced in a bubble. And despite the fact that it could make them unemployable, the universities don't care because they don't want to be criticized. That is one of the reasons that Trump was elected, is people see this happening and they cannot imagine it going farther. Lady Gaga performing at the Super Bowl and plans to denounce Trump, because let's face it, all of these great geniuses are on the same page. The media, Hollywood, were typically the people who don't even finish high school, and the overeducated university professors and the political class are all joined together in a festival of idiocy. Depressed, stand up straight. That's the answer, at least part of it. Michael Jackson is worth more than ever. Cops man, he declined his threesome with girlfriend and a second woman. Researchers are experimenting with Tinder for orangutans. Females choosing mates on a tablet for the orangutans. Miracle twins kept alive by holding hands in womb. Holy cow. Magazine Melania Trump may not move into the White House at all. I wouldn't blame her. Texas mayor comes out as a tranny. Boy. Social media makes people antisocial and jealous. People going to desperate measures to get likes. All right, so we'll take a little break here and come back and... Oh, and it's Amherst. Student expelled for sexual misconduct can't defend himself. It would impose psychological trauma on the accuser. So why don't you just go lock him up? He's been accused. That's really what they do sometimes. Here is Ray Charles and Glenn Campbell singing Crying Time, one of the greatest country songs of all time, written by Buck Owens. And here is Well, you might want to hear the opening of this between Glenn Campbell, who is a top-notch, still alive, but he's got Alzheimer's, but a top-notch studio musician. Probably the greatest performer I've ever seen in terms of playing accurately live and singing time after time. He sounds better live than he does on his records. And then Ray Charles, the immortal. Country, Ray's country, period.
You're so much better at singing and playing than just about anybody I can think of.
Well, maybe you should think a little harder.
Well, I don't think I could really come up with anybody any better, Ray.
Well, now, look, I'll tell you what. Instead of singing my praises, why don't we try mixing it up a bit?
You mean my guitar and your piano?
Well, if you feel like trading.
Nope. I haven't picked a piano up in years. Can't play one anyway. I would like to sing one with you.
Would you really sing one with me?
Oh, be the greatest thrill of my life.
All right. Join in.
All right.
Oh, it's crying time again. You're gonna need me. I can see that far away. I can tell by the way you hold me, darling, that it won't be long before it's crying time. Thank you.
Okay, so we've got, I'm trying to figure out, I think what I want to do is shift gears and get into this story on who could own space, who could mine in space. It's interesting. Here is a billionaire who is planning, and I think he is Indian, for his name here. Anyway, I'm sure he'll say it. This is from CNBC yesterday. A billionaire planning on mining the moon for trillions. Check this out.
Year we're going to be landing on the moon. So imagine one day we'll all be sitting on our knees asking our honey, will you go to the moon with me? And our goal ultimately is to create a multi-planetary society, because at the end of the day, if we don't do something, there's going to be a time when we're going to get hit by an asteroid and we're all going to become a dinosaur, and that's not something any one of us likes.
Fly me to the moon might be I guess that could be your theme song. So tell us about, this is not going to happen immediately, obviously, but tell me in sequence the 5 or 10 year plan for this, Naveed.
Sure. So we're going to land on the moon this year, and I have been waiting to say that for so long. It is going to be this year. And the first mission is going to be a robotic mission, and we're going to be exploring the moon for the natural resources. But our ultimate goal is to not only use the resources for the benefit of humanity, whether it is bringing the helium-3 or whether it's bringing the platinum-grade material, but also to really use the resources to live on the moon. And my hope is that our landing on the moon will simply is symbolic of what entrepreneurs are capable of doing. So imagine when we land on the moon, not only we become the first company ever to do so, we become the fourth superpower. And that just goes on to show that the next set of superpowers are likely to be entrepreneurs, whether it's Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos or Moon Express, that is going to go out and solve the world's biggest problems. And my hope is that this will inspire every entrepreneur to find their own moonshot, just like I found my another moonshot, which is called Viome, we as in Victor, I-O-M-E, where we are solving a healthcare problem. And it's not going to be Obamacare or Trumpcare that's going to actually solve it. Imagine living in the world where sickness becomes optional. That means you are able to live in the world where we're going to find the disease, cure the disease even before you see the symptom, and that world is well within our reach, and entrepreneurs are going to solve those problems.
Yeah. If sickness were optional, you have to be a real weird person to take that option, I think. That's for
sure. Well, actually, what happens is people take that option every day by eating the food that's not good for them, right?
Right.
So when you tell someone and say, hey, you really should be eating, this, and they say, no, I'm going to eat burger and fries, that's the choice they make every single day. And our hope is that we are able to personalize the diet and nutrition really by looking inside your body to see what is going on, the biochemistry of the body and your gut. Because at the end of the day, the majority of the diseases start in your gut, and you take care of those trillions of...
All right, so what this guy is talking about is going up to the moon and getting, I'm sure for himself, it is in the interest of personal enrichment, but talking about going to the moon, going to asteroids... And this type of thing, and getting riches and getting things that could revolutionize healthcare. Now, here's new mining law might violate UN's Outer Space Treaty. This is from Newsy.
President Obama signed a law which would allow U.S. space firms to own and sell resources mined in space. But the law might conflict with the United Nations Outer Space Treaty of 1967. The treaty makes clear that outer space isn't subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty, by means of use or occupation, or by any other means. But the new law is careful to only give private ownership to anything extracted from a celestial object, not to the object itself. So it's not entirely clear if the new law violates that part of the treaty. According to some experts, where the new law seems to run into trouble is in Articles 1 and 9 of the treaty, which says that nation states are to avoid harmful contamination of space and celestial bodies. and that outer space can only be used for the benefit and the interests of all countries. For its part, the U.S. House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology says it's not violating international law. Either way, we've still got a couple years to work out the legal kinks. Planetary Resources, an asteroid mining company, thinks it'll be 2025 before asteroid mining is ready to begin in earnest. For Newsy, I'm Leah Becerra.
All right, so there is on the question of the legitimacy or the legality of doing interstellar mining. Take a break and pick this up again. What is space law? And if you want to approach this from a Jeopardy angle. And, you know, there's this great story out there by Robert Heinlein called The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And it's about a colony that is set up on the moon. And the colony rebels and becomes kind of a libertarian center. It's very interesting. 523-1450 to call in. Fly in the friendly skies at 727 AM Las Cruces with Kelly O'Connell. Be right back.
Now they say that absence makes the heart grow fonder, and that tears are only rain to make love grow. Where my love for you.
Space law. Is there such a thing of space law? Why, of course there is, my friends. Here is a little bit on who owns. Well, actually, here's another. Hold on. Just a second. Here is another clip on mining, asteroid mining in space. Is it legal?
I'm Lee Pacquia. Last week, a new company backed by Google executives and filmmaker James Cameron, among others, announced plans to start mining near-Earth asteroids for precious metals and water. My guest today says that once you get past the technological challenges facing Planetary Resources, that's the name of the new company, there are real legal issues that need to be addressed. For example, who should be able to lay claim to an asteroid? Joining me now via Skype, I'm happy to say we have Professor Franz Vonderdunk, Professor of Space Law at the University of Nebraska Lincoln College of Law. Professor, thank you so much for joining us today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
So, okay, before we get to the law, I got to say, I've been looking forward to doing this story all week. What should we make of this news? Is there a serious chance that we could see a private company mining asteroids for gold and platinum in 10 years' time?
Absolutely. I think it's always a little bit of looking into a crystal ball, but the technology is rapidly being developed. The Japanese, a couple of years ago, have actually made a landing, a robot landing on an asteroid. So I'm certain that technologically speaking, it's possible within that time frame, yes.
And the economics are certainly very favorable. There's been articles out this week saying that a single asteroid, a single rock, could hold something to the tune of $1 trillion of raw material assets, cadmium, platinum, gold, even water is valuable at that level. So there's certainly an economic incentive for this new venture to get to where it needs to be. Professor, as you know, but my audience may not, we actually have law governing stuff like this. The 1967 Outer Space Treaty, I guess the relevant part of it would be Article 2, which reads, outer space, including the moon and other celestial bodies, is not subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty, by means of use or occupation, or by any other means. This could mean a couple things in this particular circumstance. What do you say about it? Does that mean that it only applies to sovereign nations, or does it mean that no one owns anything in space?
Well, that's a very good question, and the answer to that tells you that in 1967, for sure, nobody thought something like this was possible, certainly not with private money. Because the long and short of Article 2 is that as a consequence thereof, no single state can exercise territorial sovereignty over outer space, and this means in turn that no state can apply its national laws to outer space as if it was, say, a U.S. territory. And if you talk about private appropriation, private mining, obviously you need a government to regulate that, to regulate the licensing, to regulate the conditions under which a license can be given. And normally speaking, such licenses under the control of a government are only applicable to the territory of that very government. But since an asteroid can never be part of the territory of one state or another, by definition, these laws about how to mine and what the conditions are cannot as such apply to the moon or any asteroid.
What other issues do you see cropping up once a project like this gets off the ground, so to speak?
Well, one thing which should bother the private operators themselves, of course, is the legal certainty that they have, the thing they extracted out there, is not going to be interfered with without any legal defense. The nice thing of a global commons is that everybody is in principle entitled to make use and explore and to a certain extent exploit that, but it also does not put any boundaries on others to respect the exploitation of one particular group or another, and that is something which is missing. Another issue which is very important is the liability issue. Again, there has been a specific convention drafted in the early 1970s to address liability in space in general, but nobody foresaw this type of event happening. So what if the company in mining an asteroid inadvertently causes parts of that asteroid to get into the orbit of a valuable communication satellite? Does that liability regime, which was not developed for those type of circumstances, does it apply? Would it apply? Or even worse, if some part of that asteroid would then change its original trajectory and start heading for Earth? Is there any liability and responsibility involved in that?
All right, so there's some of the issues to think about. And so, I mean, mining an asteroid, I don't know if it would be as difficult as landing on the moon and hanging out there for a few days. I mean, certainly we have the technology, to quote the $6 million man. So if we wanted to do that, and let me take a little break here and see if I can find for you just a little clip on one more clip on mining an asteroid. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces. Then we'll come back and talk about a few more earthbound issues. 7:37 AM Las Cruces, flying those probably a little turbulent skies right now with what's going on in Washington. But we'll be right back. AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523 1450 with Little Ray Charles.
Oh, it's crying time again. You're gonna leave me.
Okay, since we're on the topic, let's get ready for the gold rush, friends.
The idea that we could mine asteroids for over 100 years, right? Late 1800s is when we first started thinking about this in the first place. And today we have, I think it's three or four different asteroid mining companies. It's no longer an idea. We actually have companies that are actively pursuing this. And we also have really serious economic reasons for pursuing this, right? A lot of the metals, rare earth metals, that we need to make all of our electronic gear, they're very scarce on Earth, totally plentiful in space.
Confusion, tension, uncertainty.
Fantastic conductor. We don't build technology around it very much because all the platinum on Earth would essentially fit into the back of a flatbed truck, right? There's a very limited supply. It is everywhere in space. So there, if you look at the history of the world, always been the search for resources that has opened up new frontiers. It's been the economic driver that has opened up new frontiers. Well, that economic driver is, you know, is there in space. And you have to think about it this way. You go back 20 years ago, right, when Shell discovered the first North Sea oil deposit. It was beneath 5,000 feet of water and 10,000 feet of rock, and they had to operate in this very cold, very hostile, very far away environment robotically to get at oil. It's resource extraction. North Sea oil platforms are very, very expensive, but we learned Shell was willing to take a very, very expensive bet to operate robotically in a very hostile, distant, far and away environment to get at resources, right? Same budget sort of applies to asteroid mining, and it's the same exact situation. It's a very far away, very remote, robotically extracted resource if we're mining asteroids. So we've done this before. We've been down this exact road. And for the first time in history, we have the technology, right? We've already, there have been three different missions already, two out of NASA and one out of Japan, that have caught up to asteroids. We even won the Hayabusa, which is the Japanese probe, scratched the surface and brought back some dust. It's the low-grade first step mining, right? So we already have proof of concept. We know it can be done. We know the resources are out there, and there are companies pursuing it. Will it happen in the next 20, 25 years, next 10 years, next 20 to 25 years?
All right, so here's just a little bit from Smithsonian on what their plans are. Not the Smithsonian, but what the there's a plan to get some minerals from space, including making a water station out beyond the Earth's atmosphere. Check this out.
People are seeing it regularly in the Washington Post, the New York Times, all the other papers. There's water on the moon. What does that mean?
The component gases of water, hydrogen and oxygen, when converted to a liquid form, is the most powerful chemical propellant we know of. In fact, the space shuttle main engines use liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen.
One corporation plans to mine the moon's water and deliver it to a fuel station in Earth orbit.
If you work from the moon by using very carefully defined, optimized procedures, you can reduce the cost of getting raw materials to Earth orbit by a factor of up to 20 to 1. So it's inevitable that if the fuel is there, people are going to buy it.
Once we've got a good transport infrastructure in place and we can begin to exploit the resources of the moon, then bringing lunar oxygen into low Earth orbit to fuel all of the activities, that's a major breakthrough. The consequence of that is that the missions that we can consider will be on a scale which I think defies imagination at this point in time.
A resupply station in Earth orbit would be a stepping stone into deep space.
Low Earth orbit is the first stopping point you have in space to go anywhere in space. The process of getting there is half the job of getting to anywhere in the universe.
Several companies are already marketing services outside our orbit, including mining for precious minerals on nearby asteroids. And government space agencies and private companies alike are currently drawing up plans for travel to Mars.
To get to Mars, you're going to need a spacecraft in the 700-ton region. There's no way you can launch that in one piece. It's got to be launched in pieces. It's got to be launched cost-effectively.
One company suggests sending robots to build settlements so humans arrive with a place to stay. All of this creativity in the private sector can be traced back to NASA's pedigree of groundbreaking work.
NASA has spent 50 years inventing the technologies that never existed before. We are the beneficiaries of all of that hard sweat and work. They have made possible what can now be done by private enterprise. That's really what this is all about.
So it's a two-pronged effort to, number one, enrich the Earth through, raw materials. The second one, though, and this might be more of a long-term goal, is to build space stations and facilities on other planets or other, say, bodies to large asteroids or more likely the moon, places like that, so that we can create the infrastructure for interstellar travel. Kelly O'Connelly, MLS Cruises, AM 1455-2314. We'll be right back.
That far away look in your eyes. I can tell. And it won't be long before it's crying time.
$7.50. And here's a little bit from Nate Bargatze on Walmart, eating in Walmart and Kmart.
I'm a big fan of Applebee's, you know. It's really just whatever. If I eat somewhere that's not Applebee's, I will only eat what Applebee's would serve. Like, if Applebee's is not on board with it, I'm not going to be, you know. I eat at Walmart. You can eat there. It's fine. They're fine with it. And Walmart's great. They're always open. No one likes, you know, no one likes Walmart, but they're always open. That's why they're great. There was a fire at a Walmart, and they did not shut down. They remained open during the fire. Like, some people didn't even know there was a fire. Other people thought they were just selling fire. Like, that's not that crazy of a thing. I'm a Walmart guy. I think I'm in the middle, you know? I'm not Kmart, but I'm not Target, you know? I'm not old money. I don't think I'm better than everybody. Just right in the middle. You ever go to Kmart? Like, Kmart doesn't even look open when you go in there. You just walk in, you're like, you guys about to close? Are you getting looted or something? You're like, no, we're open. Are you? Are you going to cut the lights on that side of the store? Maybe get some stuff, you know? Kmart looks like where you go buy stuff if you're about to open a new Kmart. If you need a shelf for your Kmart, you're going there and be like, this is good. I think we're going to do it right here.
Little Nate Bargatze there. Okay, so we're having exciting days here. We've got a new Supreme Court justice who appears to be bought into not just the natural law, but the new updated natural law. And the natural law always has to adapt and grow, which it's doing, whether people realize it or not. And so anyway, there's going to be a fight against the Republicans. There already is. I mean, there has been a fight since news was invented. There has been this constant drip, 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 and attack against the conservatives. Why does everybody hate the conservatives, by the way, even though it becomes so obvious that only the conservative approach is really effective? What is it in the mind of the true far leftist to stick to something that is so obviously so detrimental and deadly as Marxism, socialism, progressivism, communism, fill in the blank, help me out here, fascism? What is it about? I mean, I should ask my sister, but I think she'd want to try to kill me. I can't really talk politics with my sister. Either one of my sisters, because they really get upset. And then my brother sent this picture of himself standing next to a picture of Hillary after Trump won, and it caused a lot of chaos in the family. We've got a call. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
Chris.
Good morning, Chris. Thanks for the call. Hope you're well, and what's on your mind?
Well, your last statement, what is in the mind of the uber liberal left?
Yes.
Against conservatism.
Against reality, really, but go ahead.
Yeah, well, that's true. One lives in reality, the other lives in unreality, you know. They want to redefine all everything, you know. Pancakes are not pancakes, they're children. And, you know, they want to change everything. But I think what's at the core is that lefties have a religion, and their religion is liberalism. And because it's more of a religion. You know, they're godless. They, you know, they hate Christians and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they really do not have a religion except it's liberalism. And at the core there, I think, is this higher moral ground, that they believe they have a higher moral ground.
Yes.
And the reason that they hate conservatives so much, vitriolic, is because conservatives challenge their moral ground. And when you challenge a religious person's moral grounds, you've gotten to the core of who they are.
It gets pretty nasty. I would agree 100%. And there's this idea that I read in Eric Voglin, that it is the movement of deicide, that they want to kill God. They want to kill God because if you kill God, you kill sin. If you kill sin, then you get rid of the problem in human history, which is, you know, all around us, I guess, it's death and destruction. It's no matter how well you live your life, everybody is going to pass on into some other realm in which we have no control.
Right. Yeah. And the whole idea is no morals. You cannot have a moral right and wrong. They're just, you know, they're conservative morals are backwards and stupid and everything else. But their morals are, you know, of a higher sort. And they're, and that's why, like I said, you attack a person's religious fervor of believing they have the higher ground, and
it gets ugly. I'm out of time, Chris. This is a fascinating topic. Any chance we can pick it up again later?
Yeah, I'll call you back.
Thank you. All right, folks. Can't really disagree with that. It is kind of fascinating to me, though. There is this, you know, it is just absolutely shocking. You know, we have this veneer over human society that everything's up to date and organized and underneath it is a lot of chaos. And I think the left brings chaos to the table because they can't fit in with the history of the West, and they want to overturn that history, even though by watching, by observation, you can see that when that happens, it's absolute pandemonium. It's carnage, it's destruction, it's torture, it's every conceivable failure. All right, so Texas mayor, speaking of which, becomes first elected official to come out as transgender. How would you like that if Ken Miyagashima pulled that stunt? 8 months after taking office, the mayor of a small Texas town has become the first transgender elected official to come out publicly in the state's history, saying, quote, as your mayor, I must tell you something that has been with me since my earliest memories. I am a tranny, says Jess Herbst, mayor of New Hope in Collin County. All right, shifting gears here. The moon is a harsh mistress. We're talking about space law. A book of fiction by Robert Heinlein. It's about a lunar colony's revolt against the rule of Earth. The novel expresses and discusses libertarian ideals. It is respected for its credible presentation of a comprehensively imagined future human society on both Earth and the moon. And do you ever ask yourself if human courts and Congress has ruled on something about space, does anybody have do they have the jurisdiction? 6:59, Kelly O'Connell, have a great day. We'll meet you back in 22 hours. Ciao.
Now you say you found someone that you love better, but that's the way it's happened every time before. And as sure as the sun comes up tomorrow,
it's all right.
Crying time will start when you walk out the door.
Yep.
Oh, it's crying time again. You're gonna leave.